This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning. Welcome to AM. I'm Cyber Elaine. On today's program, a bizarre media appearance by the two Russians accused of poisoning a former spy in the UK. As the US braces for one storm, President Trump reignites controversy over the death toll from another. And the man who used to manage the Commonwealth's Environment Water Entitlement tells us what he thinks of the Deputy Prime Minister's idea of diverting Murray-Darling environmental water to help drought-affected farmers.
Take the water away and you've condemned the wetlands, the rivers and the floodplains of the Murray-Darling Basin to a slow death. You can kiss it goodbye. Does Mr. McCormack know how long this drought will go?
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, wanted a woman. Instead, the pre-selectors of Wentworth have chosen a man. It's the prized Sydney federal seat vacated by Malcolm Turnbull. After a lengthy meeting finishing around 2 this morning, Australia's former ambassador to Israel, Dave Sharma, won. Angus Randall was there.
It began before sunset, while on nearby rugby fields, local teams geared up for the finals. At East's Rugby Club in the Sydney suburb of Rose Bay, candidates and their supporters were making last-ditch efforts to gather votes. Candidates and delegates were told not to speak to the media waiting outside. The former ambassador to Israel, Dave Sharma, was one of the few who made even minor remarks.
Confident? I think it'll be a good contest.
After 6.5 hours of speeches and voting, there was a winner.
I don't think we're going to have a doorstop, but I will let you know that the ballot was won by Dave Sharma.
He had the support of some powerful allies. Former Prime Minister John Howard had backed the former ambassador to Israel. So had the man he could replace, Malcolm Turnbull. Dave Sharma is ready for October.
Thanks so much. It's been a long evening, but I'm honoured to have been pre-selected as the Liberal candidate for the seat of Wentworth. We have a tough fight ahead of us to hold on to this seat, but I'll be throwing my all into it, and I believe we can retain it and retain a Liberal government in Canberra. Thank you so much.
If you weren't the Prime Minister's pick, is that going to be a problem?
And then he was off to celebrate, or more likely at 2 a.m, to sleep. It's a blow for Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who'd called for a woman to take the post left vacant by Malcolm Turnbull. The final three left in the race were all men: Victor, Dave Sharma, local councillor Richard Shields, and the former member for Wentworth, Peter King. Former Liberal Party staff member Mary Lou Jarvis and expected frontrunner Catherine O'Regan finished fourth and fifth.
Angus Randall reporting there. And for more on the Wentworth by-election race, I'm joined now by political reporter Stephanie Burris. And Stephanie, it's not the outcome that Scott Morrison wanted.
No, it's not, Sabra. And up to the last minute, moves were underway to try and force Dave Sharma to step away from the race. The ABC understands senior Liberal figures, including Arthur Sinodinos, called on him to withdraw. But as we've heard, obviously, that did not occur. Now, Scott Morrison wanted a female candidate. This would have helped him battle the women problem the Liberal Party is facing at the moment with a lack of representation in Parliament. And having a female Liberal candidate would have helped Mr. Morrison to turn that image around, but it wasn't to be. So last night was effectively a loss for him. Malcolm Turnbull, who was backing Dave Sharma, has tweeted overnight saying, "As a diplomat, Dave has represented Australia magnificently overseas and now, if elected, will make a great contribution in our national parliament." Scott Morrison has now taken to Twitter this morning. Obviously, of course, now he is backing in Dave Sharma because he is the candidate. Scott Morrison tweeting, "A quality guy with extensive experience and capability. The best candidate won. That's how it should be. Of course, I want to see more Liberal women in Parliament, but I always want to see the best candidate selected."
So I guess now, who is Mr. Sharma up against in the fight to actually win that seat?
So Labor's chosen Tim Murray, and then there's also business owner and City of Sydney councillor Angela Vithoulkas. She's already standing as an independent. The question mark, Sabra, though, remains over Dr. Karen Phelps. She's a City of Sydney city councillor who may well run as an independent and have a good shot at winning, but that's yet to be seen. Also, I think we do have to point out today, Sabra, that 3 years ago to this day, Malcolm Turnbull took on the top job as Prime Minister, and 3 weeks ago, Scott Morrison took over the leadership role.
Steph, on a separate matter, the Prime Minister's also been forced to take down a video from his Twitter feed and apologise. What's that about?
This one's a little bit bizarre. So Scott Morrison posted a short video from Question Time where all members of the coalition were putting their hands up, and then there was music playing over it, and the choice of song has some people fuming. It's a hip-hop track. It's called Be Faithful by Fat Man Scoop. And the lyrics that played while these politicians were putting their hands up was, you got a $100 bill, put your hands up. You got a $50 bill, put your hands up. However, other parts of the song that weren't played include expletives and sexual references. So Scott Morrison has pulled the video down. He's apologised, saying that the lyrics are not okay. When he found out, he asked the team to get rid of it. Sabra, though, I would argue the more bizarre element of this video and this tweet was the wording that Scott Morrison put with it, saying Question Time was on fire. I would argue it was actually quite boring and there was not much discussion about policy. Labor very much was hammering the coalition over their internal problems.
Stephanie Boris, thank you. You're listening to AM around the country where it's 5 minutes past eight. Some farmers have given it a resounding thumbs up, but others aren't convinced by the idea of diverting environmental water from the Murray-Darling Basin to help drought-affected farmers. The special drought envoy, Barnaby Joyce, has floated the idea, and it was backed by the Nationals leader, Michael McCormack, yesterday on AM. He says every measure needs to be looked at in these dire circumstances. The Environment Minister, Melissa Price, has ruled out any plans to change the legislation to allow those water allocations. With more, here's Sandra Seagian.
For almost eight decades, Matt Glowry's family has run a dairy farm in the northwest Victorian town of Swan Hill. And he thinks diverting environmental water from the Murray-Darling River system to help drought-affected farmers like himself is a great idea.
It would certainly help not just irrigation farms, but everyone that has livestock that need feeding. And it doesn't matter where you are in Victoria, you would get the benefits of that fodder. The fact that people are looking at closing down businesses, and I think it's communities that are affected by this, is far more important at the moment than temporary influx of some water.
Louise Burge is a farmer near the town of Deniliquin in the Murray region in southwestern New South Wales. She also thinks the idea has merit.
Crops in the ground at the moment are suffering from moisture stress, and it is critically important to save what those crops that can be saved, to bring forward an early allocation, even if it's only, you know, 1, 2, 3%, 4%, utilising any environmental water that's available. That would certainly help a lot of farmers.
James Jackson is the president of the New South Wales Farmers Association. He thinks the proposition seems attractive, but has some reservations.
If it does happen, we think there should be some caveats around the management of it. We think it should only go to licence holders and there should be caps, and that it can't be traded, because what tends to happen is that these water would end up with, traders, and it wouldn't be used for hay production anyhow.
Jody Swirapik is the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder, the officer in charge of ensuring the Murray-Darling Basin benefits from environmental flows. In a statement she wrote, recognising that environmental watering already provides some co-benefits for communities, the redirection of environmental water to farmers is not possible under the law as it currently stands. To give effect to the proposal would require a change to the Water Act 2007. Lynn Crace is an economics professor at the University of South Australia. He thinks if the federal government starts handing out environmental water for free, it will add unnecessary uncertainty to the market.
A market was created for the purchase and selling of water entitlements for a reason. It was to enable farmers to be much more adaptive. We know that with the last drought, if it wasn't for the water market, many farmers would have gone broke. So we know now that farmers use the market as a very clever tool for dealing with drought and dealing with scarcity.
That's economics professor Lynn Crace from the University of South Australia, ending Sandra Seagian's report. The man who used to manage the Commonwealth's environment water entitlement says the idea is bad, dangerous, and would blow up the Murray-Darling Basin plan. Until he retired at the start of this year, David Papps was the Commonwealth environmental water holder in charge of managing the environmental water rights. He joined me earlier.
It's a bad idea. It's illegal. Under the Commonwealth Water Act, can't be done, and it can't be done for good reason.
So it's not just about a legal technicality. The environment needs water in a drought, and the environment is in desperate straits, and taking water away from it will undo the good that has been done already, and is effectively a waste of the billions of dollars that have been invested so far.
Mr. McCormick acknowledged yesterday that there would need to be a legislative change if this happened. But if it did happen, what would be the consequence to the Murray-Darling Basin plan?
Well, you will blow up the basin plan. There's no point in having it. If you've taken away the water upon which the outcomes depend, then you've really wasted that entire reform. And let's not forget what that reform cost. It was controversial. It was divisive. The arguments were difficult and complex. And we got to a position where no one was entirely happy with the basin plan. The irrigators weren't entirely happy with it. Conservationists weren't entirely happy with it. But everyone could live with it. And we've been getting on with it since. And we know from the work that we've done, and when I was the Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder, we were clearly seeing signs of improvement in the environment. So we know that it's working. Take the water away and you've condemned the wetlands, the rivers and the floodplains of the Murray-Darling Basin to a slow death. You can kiss it goodbye. And this notion that you can borrow water and pay it back. Does Mr. McCormick know how long this drought will go? It could go on for years, and each and every year he will come back for more environmental water. So it is the death knell for, you know, the great iconic wetlands like the Macquarie Marshes and the Coorong and the rivers like the Darling.
And taking water from the environment in this way, what would happen to water rights as a precedent?
Well, I think that's a very important question. So one of the great parts of this reform, one of the strokes of genius that sits behind it, is that the Commonwealth has purchased entitlements, which is a legal property right to water. So these are the same entitlements that, say, a rice farmer or a cotton farmer own. And for the first time, the environment owns entitlements. If McCormack's idea proceeds, he's basically saying this. He's saying that the environment and environmental water is second class. And that any time that he or some other politician chooses to interfere, you can simply divert that water back into irrigation, back into farming. And you've effectively said that the property rights attached to it are second class. It is a dangerous precedent, I would have thought, for the irrigation industry, who might want to think about what would happen under a government that is less sympathetic to them than the current administration. The best thing all round is to leave this alone, to get on with implementing the Basin Plan. It is working, and politicians need to stay out of it. That's why the Water Act was constructed so very carefully by Malcolm Turnbull in 2007, to ensure that they couldn't make these decisions.
What about the point that the Deputy Prime Minister made yesterday, that the environment, trees and frogs all bounce back better than farmers do after a drought?
Nonsense. I mean, the man appears to be scientifically illiterate, and we shouldn't be surprised given the fact that he doesn't accept the science of climate change either. The wetlands, rivers and floodplains of the basin haven't bounced back. They've suffered decades of abuse from over-extraction of water, from regulation and from terrible catchment management practices. And it's very, very clear that they don't bounce back like that. It's going to take decades for them to recover. That's the point of the basin plan, that we've got water set aside in perpetuity for decades to get these places back into health. And, you know, I don't know who Mr. McCormack is listening to. I mean, he's certainly not listening to any scientist or anyone who knows anything about the basin and its rivers. I suspect, unfortunately, he's being guided in this regard by our drought envoy, who knows less than he does.
How would you characterise the idea then? Is it false hope in a way?
Yeah, it's false hope. I mean, you know, is he really going to get change through the Commonwealth Parliament? He can't even convince the Federal Environment Minister or the Federal Agricultural Minister. I mean, Minister Littleproud is in the National Party, and he's not convinced. So to keep holding this out to struggling farmers is an insult. It's just raising false hope. And, you know, there's no universal view amongst irrigators anyway. There are plenty of sensible irrigators and people like the National Farmers Federation who say this is a bad idea. They agree with me. So it's a bad idea. It's dangerous. It's undermining, white anting, decades of difficult reform, and it's going to stop the recovery of these fabulous places. The only reason I'm not completely pessimistic is I just don't think it can happen. I just don't think that even this government is stupid enough to do this.
That's David Papps, the former Commonwealth Environmental Water Holder. The Deputy Prime Minister, Michael McCormack's, told AM in a statement the government needs to look at all options to help farmers and farming communities facing what is a devastating drought. Mr McCormack says the government also needs to look at the detail thoroughly and ensure there are no unintended consequences of any decisions, such as redirecting water flows. It was all about seeing a cathedral and its spire, according to the two Russian men accused of a nerve agent attack in the UK. They've given an extraordinary interview on Russian state TV, saying they were in the UK as tourists, not to poison the former Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter. The British Prime Minister, Theresa May, has condemned the interview as full of lies. Europe correspondent Samantha Hawley reports.
On Russian state TV, the men confirmed they'd been in Salisbury for 2 days in March.
We are those who were shown to you in the pictures, Ruslan Bashirov and Alexander Petrov.
Are those your real names?
Yes, they are our real names.
In an often bizarre exchange with the interviewer, they were asked a series of staged questions, declaring themselves innocent, cathedral-loving tourists.
Our friends had been suggesting for a long time that we visit this wonderful town.
Salisbury, a wonderful town?
There's the famous Salisbury Cathedral, famous not only in Europe, but in the whole world. It's famous for its 123-metre spire. It's famous for its clock, the one of the first ever created in the world that's still working.
Ruslan Bozhirov and Alexander Petrov were accused by the UK last week of trying to kill ex-Russian spy Sergei Skripal and his daughter by spraying a military-grade nerve agent, Novichok, on the front door of their home in Salisbury. Questioned if they'd been near the Skripals' home, they said if they were, they wouldn't have known it.
Where do you work? You're adults who need to make a living.
To cut a long story short, we're in the fitness industry.
Dr. Andrew Foxall, the director of Russian studies at the Henry Jackson Society, says the interview was absurd.
It's frankly laughable. The excuse seems to be that that for whatever reason, they if they were really tourists in Salisbury, why stay in Bow in East London? Perhaps they were also visiting local tourist attractions there.
And as the interview rolled on, the Russian pair were demanding an apology.
By who? The perpetrators?
By UK authorities. I'm lost. I don't know what day it is. We can't go outside. We can't go to the petrol station. You can't imagine what our lives turned into.
They're safe in the knowledge that they have the backing of President Vladimir Putin, who'd already cleared them of any wrongdoing. This is Samantha Hawley in London, reporting for AM.
Hurricane Florence has been downgraded to a Category 2 storm as it bears down on the US East Coast, but officials are warning it could still claim many lives. While the storm's wind speed has dropped, predictions of the amount of rainfall it will bring are unchanged and there are fears of catastrophic flooding. Our North America correspondent Zoe Daniel is in Wilmington, North Carolina.
I'm standing on the banks of the Cape Fear River in the town of Wilmington, so in the CBD, and it is very blustery. The rain has just started now. The wind has been quite gusty here this morning, and compared to yesterday, the environment's very different. It's a very heavy grey sky. We're already seeing down on the coast some early signs of storm surge, particularly on those outer barrier islands that exist here in North Carolina, where water is already surging over the beaches and through coastal properties. This is clearly just a sign of things to come. The storm's not really expected to build up properly until this evening, so in several hours, and it will go through the night. The bigger issue, though, Sabra, probably, is the rainfall that it will bring, because the storm, because the wind speed has dropped a bit. It's been downgraded to a Category 2 storm. It's just hovering on that cusp of Category 2 and 3. Some people are taking that as a sign that the storm itself has weakened, but what has happened during that change is that the storm has spread out, and that is concerning forecasters because that means that a massive area across several states will be receiving catastrophic rainfall for several days.
And Zoe, the residents who've decided to stay put in the area where you are, how are they coping?
They're all very relaxed. We've spoken to several people this morning who've elected to stay, and it's important to remember that there's sort of two different types of people. There's a group that live or have holiday homes along that coastal strip, and they've been ordered to leave under a mandatory evacuation order, and the majority of them have done so. Those who are slightly away from the coast can make the choice to stay, and many are. We spoke with several elderly people this morning who are living in an independent living but a supported living home here in Wilmington. Some of them are in their 80s. One lady was over 100 years old. They have elected to stay. They've lived through many, many storms here, back to the massive Hurricane Hazel back in 1954, which is sort of the benchmark of modern hurricanes. They feel secure enough, but they are expecting strong winds, a storm surge and several days of rain. And also people are prepared perhaps for days or even a couple of weeks with no electricity.
And while the US is bracing for one storm, Zoe, there's been some further controversy over another, the one that hit Puerto Rico last year. Tell us about that.
Yes, Donald Trump has created his own form of storm in the actual week of the one-year anniversary of Hurricane Maria that hit Puerto Rico with devastating effect this time last year. Just a few weeks ago, the death toll for Puerto Rico was increased from 64 to almost 3,000. This had been an ongoing question which had been raised for that entire 12 months, that many more people were affected by that storm than the government would admit. Donald Trump came out this morning saying actually 3,000 people weren't killed. That when he went to Puerto Rico, there were two or three dozen deaths, blaming the Democrats for using or fudging figures to make him look bad. But there have been several studies and several fact checkers have debunked that, saying that, in fact, the number of around 3,000 is accurate, and it could, in fact, be substantially higher than that. And there are still studies underway looking into that.
North America correspondent Zoe Daniel. The federal opposition plans to refer an $8.7 million coalition grant to the Auditor General. The funding was awarded to Western Australia's state Labor government to keep a regional boarding college open. But federal Labor argues the coalition hasn't followed due process in approving the money. And it's also again questioning why the federal government let a One Nation senator announce a $3 million grant to a Perth soccer club. From Perth, Eliza Borrello reports.
Mora College is a publicly funded WA boarding house for country students whose parents can't afford private school fees that's been passionately defended. 9 months ago, the state Labor government announced plans to axe it, but in the aftermath of last month's federal Liberal leadership spill, the finance minister, Matthias Cormann, found Commonwealth money to save it.
I was very excited on behalf of the Mora community that the Premier and I, representing the state and federal governments, so were able to find a way forward.
He announced the money would come from the government's Community Development Grants Program. Its guidelines state a formal proposal must be submitted by a proponent before a grant can be approved. In this case, the proponent would be the WA government. But the state's Premier, Mark McGowan, says his administration hadn't submitted a proposal before the grant was announced.
Not as far as I'm aware. Whatever processes the Commonwealth went through is a matter for them.
Despite the admission, Senator Cormann argues process was followed.
Yes, absolutely. These were policy decisions of the government.
But the federal Shadow Regional Development Minister, Stephen Jones, disagrees and plans to refer the grant to the Auditor General.
It seems to me quite clear that the government has not followed its own guidelines.
He's also questioning why One Nation Senator Peter Georgiou was tasked with announcing $3 million worth of funding from the same program program to a Perth soccer club.
Normally, ministers and backbenchers are falling over each other to stand there on the podium to make an announcement such as this.
In a statement, Senator Cormann said he was scheduled to make the soccer announcement but was held up in Canberra because of his party's leadership change. Andrew Podger is an honorary public policy professor at the Australian National University. He's also held some of the most senior roles in the federal bureaucracy, including Secretary of the Health Department and Public Service Commissioner. Professor Podger says the Community Development Grants Program's guidelines are weak and projects are being chosen without appropriate discipline.
It does appear to be a pork barrelling exercise that's not going through as robust a process. Don't get me wrong, it is abiding by the law, and the ANAO itself is saying that, you know, not questioning the legality of it, but I don't think it actually is best practice by any means.
In another statement, Senator Cormann said both projects have been budgeted for and money will flow once the funding terms and agreements are signed by the relevant parties.
Eliza Borello reporting. When Indonesia's currency collapsed 20 years ago, it prompted one of the biggest upheavals the country's ever seen, with the Reformasi riots and the end of the Suharto regime. Today, the rupiah is sliding again, edging levels not seen since the 1998 currency crisis. In the lead-up to next year's election, analysts believe it's bad news for President Joko Widodo, who's chosen a Muslim cleric with relatively little experience in economic matters as his running mate. Indonesia correspondent David Lipson's filed this report.
This music video is one of the weapons being used by Indonesia's Change President movement. In the clip, musicians and politicians wearing headphones in a recording studio take turns to complain about life under President Joko Widodo. Food prices going up, they sing, electricity prices going up, the price of fuel increasing in the night. In the world's largest Muslim-majority nation, there are signs of a major shift in focus for next year's presidential poll, from religion to the economy. It's being driven by a 9% fall this year in the value of the Indonesian currency, the rupiah, which now edges 15,000 to the US dollar, a figure not seen since the 98 collapse. Professor of Economics at ANU, Hal Hill.
Indonesia had one of the modern world's biggest economic crises in 1997-98 when the rupiah went into free fall and the banking sector collapsed. And of course, it triggered the collapse of the Suharto regime. So every time you get significant movements in the rupiah, people begin to get a little bit edgy.
The currency concerns are well short of those in Turkey and Argentina. The current fall in the rupiah is nowhere near as precipitous as that of 98, and the Indonesian economy today is much better equipped to respond. Still, it presents a risk to President Joko Widodo's re-election campaign should inflation start to bite. Non-resident fellow at the Lowy Institute, Matthew Bush.
If food prices started to go up considerably, that could be a real problem. That is something that historically has moved votes.
The president has imported 2 million tons of rice this year, much more than usual, to ease the upward pressure. But his opponent, former military strongman Prabowo Subianto, can see an opening, releasing a statement citing grave concerns about the weakening currency and placing the blame at the feet of the popular President Widodo. Political risk analyst and author of Reformasi Information Services, Kevin O'Rourke, says the president's running mate, a conservative Muslim cleric chosen to boost his religious credentials, now presents a problem.
Widodo is approaching the election using the tactics from the previous war, so to speak. In fact, now it appears as if his opponents will be criticizing him mainly for his handling of the economy, and Widodo's running mate is no help at all in that arena. In fact, he's probably a hindrance.
On the other hand, he says challenger Prabowo is running with a wealthy and astute businessman, Sandiaga Uno.
And so these two factors can make the presidential election contest a bit more competitive, possibly too competitive for comfort.
With 7 months to go, there's plenty of time for tactics and fortunes to shift again. This is David Lipson in Jakarta for AM.
Now let's check finance. Wall Street's ended higher after a lift in Apple shares and easing trade tensions. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 0.6%. Oil is 2% weaker at $68.73 a barrel. The Australian dollar is higher at 71.9 US cents. And that is AM for today. AM's executive producers are Michael Edwards and Barbara Miller. The associate producer is Barney Porter and political producer is Claudia Long. Technical production is by Jason Martin and Mariam Zahr and digital production by Maisie Cohen. Web publishing by Eugene Jung and Jacqueline Booth. I'm Sabra Lane. I'll be back again on Monday. Have a safe and happy weekend. It's now coming up to 8:30.